Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. I'm a little sick this week, so forgive my voice if I'm a little nasal. I have tested negative for COVID, so I think it's just a cold, but I am acting as if it's COVID anyway, to be on the safe side, which is easy for me because I have no friends and live with dogs. Anyway, this week we're going to talk to legal analyst Marcy Wheeler about where we're at in terms of prosecutions for the January 6th insurrection, as well as the larger attempted coup surrounding it. Then we'll be joined by Jared Holt. He's a researcher and journalist who tracks extremist movements, and we're going to talk to him about how the far right has kind of changed and adapted to new circumstances over the past year. But first, I want to just mention a couple of stories that you may have missed. This first one is stunning to me. Daniel Beekman reported for the Seattle Times that, and I quote, "At a crucial moment during 2020's racial justice protests, Seattle police exchanged a detailed series of fake radio transmissions about a non-existent group of menacing right-wing extremists." So there were, by the way, actual menacing right-wing extremists in Seattle surrounding those Black Lives Matter protests, but they invented fictional right-wing extremists in the hope that this would be overheard by people with police scanners and would rile up the protesters. So back to Beekman, the radio chatter about members of the Proud Boys marching around downtown Seattle, some possibly carrying guns and then heading to confront protesters on Capitol Hill, was an improper ruse or dishonest ploy that exacerbated a volatile situation, according to findings released by the Office of Police Accountability. He goes on, so Beekman goes on to say that in the days following, police leaders, quote, raised concerns about reports of armed people patrolling the zone. So these are the protesters patrolling the zone and extorting business owners. Those leaders, including then police chief Carmen Best, later walked back the extortion claim, lacking evidence. But descriptions of the scene became national news, even reaching then President Donald Trump, who threatened to take back the city. Beekman adds that it appears unlikely that anyone will lose their jobs or pay over the incident. And I just, you know, this is part of this police to right-wing media feedback loop that we've talked about on some previous shows, right? So here they are, they're riling up protesters with fake reports of Proud Boys looking for a fight. That spooked the protesters, and they did establish these like security patrols, which is always going to be a sketchy thing to have, you know, protesters patrolling. That's going to play well on Fox News. Then the police lie about the security guys, say they were extorting local businesses. And this all becomes part of the propaganda that many people believe about Black Lives Matter protesters burning down cities and causing a bunch of mayhem and whatever. And it gets all the way into Donald Trump's rhetoric, and he threatens to take over Seattle. We've got a real problem with right-wing extremism and police forces and the military in this country. I think we're just starting to grapple with it and the ramifications of that. In somewhat related news, tangentially related news, Ben Collins reports for NBC that, quote, "The sister of a federal officer allegedly killed by a member of a domestic extremist movement is suing Facebook, charging that the platform's recommendation system played a part in the radicalization of the people who are accused of carrying out the shooting." This was an awful case from 2020 when a Boogaloo boy, a so-called Boogaloo boy, these are the right-wing extremists who fantasize about civil war, so-called Boogaloo boy named Stephen Carrillo, ambushed several cops in two locations, shot four of them, killing two. And according to again, Ben Collins. Quote, Carrillo telegraphed his attack in Boogaloo Facebook groups, which were allowed on the platform until a month after the attacks, and in private messages. In one Facebook group, Carrillo suggested taking advantage of nationwide protests over the killing of George Floyd to target federal police officers, according to the complaint. So as the lawsuit alleges that Facebook, quote, knowingly promoted inflammatory and violent content and connected extremists who plotted and carried out the murder. So this is an interesting case, and we'll have to see where it goes. This is a lawsuit alleging that Facebook allowed extremism to flourish online and seeking to hold it accountable for deadly ramifications that leaked offline. And on that happy note, we're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Marcy Wheeler. Stay tuned.
Well, you've got your diamond and you've got your pretty clothes, and the chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know, but don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Your mother, she's an heiress, owns a block in St. John's Wood, and your father, be there with her if he only could. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
You can't love your country only when you win. You can't obey the law only when it's convenient. You can't be patriotic when you embrace and enable lies. Those who stormed this Capitol, and those who instigated and incited, and those who called on them to do so, held a dagger at the throat of America, at American democracy. They didn't come here out of patriotism or principle. They came here in rage. Not in service of America, but rather in service of one man.
Joe Biden spitting fire 1 year after the MAGA coup attempt, not the folksy Biden we usually see. Over the past year, 705 people have been charged in the January 6th insurrection. 370 of them are looking at felonies, 378 actually. This is according to Zoe Tillman. For BuzzFeed, she's been tracking, kind of keeping a tally of everything going on. She says, quote, the sprawling prosecution effort has been unprecedented in its scope. Some more numbers from Tillman's tally. More than 5,000 subpoenas and search warrants have been issued. 2,000 phones have been seized by the feds. They've been sifting through 300,000 tips from the public. 174 people have pled guilty, and there are a lot of people that they're still looking for. I'm joined now by veteran legal analyst Marcy Wheeler. Marcy writes at emptywheel.net. She has followed these prosecutions very closely, and I'm really happy to talk to her on the one-year anniversary of the attack. Marcy, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you again for taking the time. Normally, I would play some clips of Attorney General Merrick Garland's speech on Wednesday, but I, to tell you the truth, I found it pretty anodyne. In keeping with Justice Department norms, he didn't discuss any specific prosecutions. His message was basically like, get off my back, have some patience, and no, we aren't only looking at low-level MAGA idiots who stormed the Capitol. What was your reaction to Garland's address?
I've been fighting people on Twitter for about a month and a half who've been panicked about them not seeing in the DOJ investigation any sign that it's going anywhere. That's partly their own fault. I mean, these people haven't cracked PACER. And so, you know, they're sitting there saying there's nothing there, but I haven't looked. So my hope is that Garland's speech serve to answer their questions or just tell them, and not for the first time, that yes, DOJ is following the money. But I think that tying the January 6th investigation to voting rights and to violence against public figures, I think that that was an important move because, and I think Biden tried to do some of that today too. I think that we're not going, people need to stop thinking that the criminal investigation is going to be a silver bullet because it's not.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think it's important to tie all of this together, as you say, because it is integrally connected. You know, it is, these things are, the coup is ongoing, right? The coup attempt is ongoing. There, Trump loyalists have been taking over election boards, and there's obviously enacting all sorts of state restrictions on voting, et cetera, et cetera. So these things are all tied together. You posted, I'm going to return in a second to the charge that Garland has been less aggressive than he could be, because I definitely want to tease that out a little bit more. But before we do that, at emptywheel.net, you posted a helpful taxonomy of January 6th cases. I wonder if you could give us like a kind of a brief overview of the cases that we should be paying the most attention to, because obviously, you know, a couple hundred people have just been charged with like misdemeanors for entering a restricted area or whatever. That isn't terribly interesting. Where are we on the conspiracy cases? What should we be looking at?
Well, I want to push back, first of all, because I think some of those misdemeanors are really interesting. Okay. And let me give you an example. I mean, so I don't know if you can link the taxonomy, but one of the things I do is I talk about the four things that, and this is what Garland said in his speech. He's like, look, you know, all of these arrests lay a foundation from which we can continue to investigate. And one of the things they're doing in those arrests is arresting people who in surveillance video are obviously filming with their cameras, with their phones, following other people. So just as an example, you asked about the conspiracy cases. One of the key figures in the Oath Keeper conspiracy is this guy, Kelly Meggs, car salesman from Florida. Somehow all of the veterans decided to put him in charge. Stupid idea. But the day of the election, he told his wife and kid that he wanted to go hunt down Nancy Pelosi. And after he busted into the Capitol with that stack of people who actually were trained military veterans, he walked out of the rotunda down the hallway towards Nancy Pelosi's office.
So,
and there's one cooperator who was with him in that hallway. And it is, and afterwards he told somebody, I think his son again, he told his son, oh, I went hunting for Nancy Pelosi. So if you could say that this guy was actually hunting Nancy Pelosi, that adds 20 years to the potential sentence for the conspiracy case against him. Problem is, there's not video in that hallway. So what DOJ did was, and you could see the people that they were doing this with, they arrested the people who were following the Oath Keepers down the hallway with their phones running. Because that's how you get proof that he hunted down Nancy Pelosi the day of the riot. So that's just one example about the importance of the misdemeanors. Another one that is my favorite is this couple from South Carolina who on Facebook the day of the riot said, well, we just followed Alex Jones from the Trump speech to the northwest corner of the Capitol. And while there, he told us, he promised us, if we followed him to the east side of the Capitol, we could hear Trump speak again. And those two people got arrested because they busted in with the Oath Keepers I just talked to you about. They had no plans to bust into the Capitol that morning, but they did. They did so because they were lied to by Alex Jones. They did so because Alex Jones was moving the crowd around by lying to them about Trump speaking. And if you want Alex Jones to be prosecuted, and Alex Jones is one of the three key closest routes to go after Trump. If you want Alex Jones to be prosecuted, you need that misdemeanor witness to have said, I trespassed in the Capitol because Alex Jones lied to me. That's what they're doing with the misdemeanor cases.
So, I mean, the classic thing is you're saying they're working up from the little guys to get to the guys on top. It does seem clear that the government is putting an enormous amount of effort into holding those directly responsible for attacking the Capitol accountable. And I think that the big question that a lot of us have is whether the federal law enforcement will pursue charges related to the larger attempt to overturn the results of the election, right? Betsy Woodruff Swan from Politico, she said this week, and I will quote her, "I've seen zero indicators whatsoever that the DOJ is investigating the people close to Trump and Trump himself in relation to their efforts to overturn the election." Now, you mentioned a minute ago that you've been fighting with people who haven't cracked open
Betsy's PACER. Betsy's wrong. Betsy's wrong.
Right. So let me just finish what she says. So she's, okay. Again, I quote, "some of the leakiest people." She said her sources, her DOJ sources are some of the leakiest people who have ever lived in all of human history. We would know if DOJ were scrutinizing them. So your response.
We know that DOJ is investigating Sidney Powell. They predicated that investigation based on wire fraud, basically. Sidney Powell, at a time she knew that X, Y, and Z votes weren't stolen, raised money claiming that X, Y, Z votes were stolen. And so they're going after her in that way. We know that Roger Stone is all over that Oath Keeper investigation. At least two, and I think actually three, and at least three of those cooperating Oath Keeper witnesses had close ties, you know, even the morning of the riot. They were checking back in while they were with Roger Stone. Rudy Giuliani, his phones were seized back in April, ostensibly just for the Ukraine investigation. But the scope, the time scope for which they are getting privilege reviews of his phone goes from January 1st, 2018 until April 28th, 2021. They actually had a location tracker included in that warrant on his phone to cover some period in 2021. And we know that in the days after the riot, he was in discussions with a Proud Boy associate who was discussing individual rioters with him. In other words, like there's very good reason that to believe that there is evidence about the riot on Rudy Giuliani's phone because he texted it out with that phone. And so I think all three of them, and then Alex Jones, as I told you, I mean, they've already arrested two of Alex Jones's employees. So those are four tracks that get you directly to Donald Trump that we know they are actively, you know, we don't know what the scope of warrants they've gotten on Rudy Giuliani's phone. We know that they've spent 8 months getting a privilege review so that anything that comes out of those phones they can use, provided that they show a warrant for it. But the other three, we know they're investigating. Three ways that you get directly to Donald Trump. So it's not a matter of you need a leak. It's a matter of those are all there in the public record.
I have to say this is encouraging. It's encouraging to talk to you because I have been skeptical that people at the highest levels will face consequences. I'm not as cynical as some observers.
I want to be clear. I'm not promising they'll get there. Like, even arresting Alex Jones is they arrested Owen Schroyer, who is kind of Alex Jones Jr. They arrested him back in August. They arrested a videographer back in, I think, April. And it's clear that they believe that Owen Schroyer could be charged with what's called civil disorder, basically riling up the mob. They only charged him with trespassing so far. And they decided to charge him with trespassing because he had a pre-existing legal issue that made it a lot easier to charge him as a journalist with trespassing. They did charge him as a journalist, as opposed to like everyone else that they picked up who claimed they were doing journalism inside. They said, "You're not a journalist." So it is, you know, I don't want to minimize the ask of arresting Alex Jones. But I think that it is very easy to see DOJ going after Alex Jones and Ali Alexander. And DOJ has already debunked the cover story that they are telling about what they were doing at the Capitol that day. So, and it's like, it's on video. Alex Jones saying, let's all go to the east side of the Capitol. And it's this incredible moment where you have Alex Jones, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, some American Firsters, the Marines who broke in the east door. They all seem to know that they're going to meet at the top of the east stairs at the same time. So that's the key to what DOJ has spent the last year doing at the Capitol. And that gets you to a kind of coordination that I think people really just haven't gotten their minds around yet.
Yeah. I think that this, but we are still talking about strictly, you know, January 6th, the attack on Capitol Hill. We've had all of these revelations about attempts by Trump and his inner circle to hijack the certification process, keep Trump in power. There was the infamous phone call with officials in Georgia asking them to find, quote unquote, find 12,000 votes or whatever the number was. We learned through the House Select Committee that Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff, had a PowerPoint presentation laying out a case for Trump to declare a national emergency and basically seize power. Peter Navarro, a close advisor to Trump, crazy person, reportedly recruited over 100 Republicans in Congress into a scheme to reject the electors certified by the states. He talked about this openly. Is this something that law enforcement would see as a political dispute that's beyond the jurisdiction of the courts? Do you think that we're going to see any prosecutions arise from any of that pattern of facts?
Of the things you listed as pattern of facts, only one, which is the call to Georgia, only one is a crime in and of its own self that I know of. I mean, for example, you raised the possibility of declaring an emergency. Trump didn't do that. So the fact that he considered it and didn't do it, you can't charge him for deciding not to do it. I think that, and I've written a ton about this, the main charge that DOJ is using to charge people with felonies is obstruction of the vote certification, obstruction of a proceeding Congress, yeah. Right? And there are hundreds of people that have been charged with that. In the weeks before Christmas, five different judges all upheld that application. It wasn't clear that they were going to, but the key judge in the Oath Keeper case, key judge in the Proud Boys case, Randolph Moss, who used to be OLC head, and is actually the guy who wrote the memo, the last memo that we know of, the Clinton memo saying you can't indict a sitting president. That guy upheld this application. And then two other people, one of whom's a Trump appointee, like the second most Trump appointee in the district court. So if that holds up, then the question is, who in Trump's orbit also did that? In a hearing in November, the guy who kind of masterminded that approach, he's a prosecutor named James Pierce, he responded to Carl Nichols, another Trump appointee, who, by the way, is the guy presiding over the Steve Bannon case. Carl Nichols asked him out of the blue, basically, could we charge Trump with this? But he didn't use Trump's name. He said, could we charge somebody who asked the vice president to do something that violated his duty? And this guy Pierce said, well, not if you put it that way, but if he knew that that request was improper, if he knew that that was not a legal thing to do, then yes. Okay, so that's November, where the chief of this entire strategy is saying, if you can prove that Donald Trump knew when he asked Mike Pence to throw out the votes of seven swing states, if you can prove that, then yes, this is something that you could charge Donald Trump with. Well, I mean, one of the disclosures from the January 6th committee, the Select Committee in Congress the other day, is that Sean Hannity was writing these panic texts to Mark Meadows saying, you know, if Trump does this with Mike Pence, all the White House counsel are going to resign. He's doing that starting in December, and he's still doing that on the night before the riot. The reason that's important is because DOJ might have had a hard time getting past the legal advice that White House counsel Pat Cipollone gave to Donald Trump about whether it was legal to ask Mike Pence to, you know, throw out all these vote counts. But thankfully, Donald Trump went and blabbed his mouth to Sean Hannity, who's a journalist. He's breached his own privilege about the legal advice he got about making an illegal request of Mike Pence. And so if that advice becomes available to DOJ, thanks to Sean Hannity, then you are getting much closer to the place where you can prove that Donald Trump was trying to interrupt the vote count on January 6th. And oh, by the way, you know, one of the things that DOJ has done, and not just with those, with the militia conspiracies that you talked to, but a bunch of the people who've pled guilty in their statements of defense are saying, like the Proud Boy, the one Proud Boy who's flipped and he's cooperating against his other Proud Boys, he said specifically in his statement of defense, or he swore to, I mean, I'm sure DOJ wrote this, but he said specifically, the reason we trespassed, the reason we closed in on the Capitol rather than having a protest from the stage that Ali Alexander and Alex Jones pretended they were going to speak from, you know, closer to the Supreme Court. The reason we did that, he said, was to pressure Mike Pence to change his mind. So you've got Trump's strategy and the Proud Boys strategy that is in lockstep. Lockstep. Huh. And you've got Alex Jones between them all. So, I mean, this is why, you know, yes.
And Roger Stone.
And Roger Stone. Yeah, I mean, it's not clear what these cooperating oath keepers are saying about Roger Stone, but we know, again, that they were calling in multiple times a day from the Willard. Like, the Willard, where all that stuff happened.
The Willard Hotel.
The oath keepers are calling in to their
field theater for
that day
people
over and over again. Yes. And that they're in, you know, they're, so they're talking to, and the other thing about the other way that the Oath Keepers know Roger Stone is that in December, the car dealer I told you about, Kelly Meggs, who was hunting down Nancy Pelosi, he boasted about forming an alliance between the militias in Florida. And Roger Stone's really at the center of that. I mean, Roger Stone is closely tied to the Proud Boys and he is closely tied to the Floridian Oath Keeper. So this alliance between militias that was formed in Florida, there were other parts where the militias were coordinating. Florida is another place where Pennsylvania is another place where that happened. But Roger Stone's right there in the thick of it in December. And so those are the things that it is safe to assume DOJ is investigating. Will they get there? I can't promise you that. But yeah. This is the structure they are using. And it's not, DOJ has already said, here is a framework in which we could charge Trump with obstruction, the same way we're charging all these dirtbags who ran to the Capitol for him. And DOJ, incidentally, also has said in deciding that they were not going to replace themselves for Mo Brooks in one of the lawsuits, they said that a federal employee, and what they said applies to Trump just as much as it applies to Mo Brooks, a federal employee making speeches on January 6th was not doing that as a federal employee. They were campaigning, and campaigning is not, the Hatch Act prohibits them from campaigning as part of their federal employment. And therefore, while Mo Brooks was making that speech, which, by the way, there's a couple of statements of offense that say people responded to Mo Brooks by getting all riled up, too. I mean, this is how DOJ is working these even misdemeanor defendants by saying, you know, here's proof to how they responded to Mo Brooks. Here's proof to how they responded to Rudy Giuliani. And here's the direct effect it had an hour later down at the Capitol. But so DOJ has already argued that anything that happened at the Ellipse on January 6th is not part of federal employment because you can't campaign as a federal employee. So those are two ways that DOJ has already kind of gotten their brains around, could you charge Donald Trump? Again, I'm not promising they'll get there. I'm explaining that the framework that exists, it is very easy to see Donald Trump being plunked in a conspiracy to obstruct the vote count, I've done this over and over again. If you look at the structure they're using with the Oath Keepers, with the Proud Boys, with some people you've never heard of who also conspired Trump is doing all of that. Trump has committed the same overt acts as all of these people. The next step for DOJ in charging people like Alex Jones, and this that'll be practiced to see if they can go after somebody like Trump, is going after Alex Jones. The next step is to say, though Alex Jones didn't trespass, he actually did, but though Alex Jones didn't trespass, he still conspired to obstruct the vote count in X, Y, and Z way. And if they can show that, then they can hold him accountable the same way they hold the militias accountable. And if they can hold Alex Jones accountable, then sure, maybe they can hold Donald Trump accountable.
I mean, you make a very compelling case that the framework, as you say, is there. We've had other guests on the show previously who have argued that after William Barr's tenure, when the DOJ was very politicized and really worked to protect Trump, Garland very much wanted to reestablish the agency's independence, restore norms that had been bent or broken under Trump. And the concern that they have, and I share, is that he may be overcompensating in that effort. And trying to avoid going after Trump and members of his inner circle, because that would be received by millions of Americans as a political prosecution. In other words, there is prosecutorial discretion. There is the idea that maybe you would do more damage to the country by going after senior Trump officials or Trump himself than you would then it would be a greater threat to like tear the country apart than the challenge to the rule of law. And
so
I think
let me give you several examples where there's proof to the contrary that people keep ignoring, but there is an investigation into a Trump associate. I won't name the person, but there is a grand jury investigation to a Trump associate that is kind of a reopening of a grand jury investigation that Bill Barr shut down. So that's one. You've heard of the person, but it's not public yet, and so I don't want to be the one making it public. Two, going after Sidney Powell, the theory that they're using to go after Sidney Powell, by all appearances, is the same theory that they used to go after Steve Bannon. It's a fairly aggressive theory. They're willing to go after Sidney Powell, at least open the investigation and conduct it. If they go after Sidney Powell, that is, you know, she was central to all of this. Three, literally the first thing that Lisa Monaco did after she became deputy attorney general, by all appearances, was approve the raid on Rudy Giuliani. Literally the first thing. And that is an incredibly aggressive thing. And, you know, as I told you, the scope of what they're getting from his phones, it is quite possible, because we know they had probable cause against Rudy Giuliani going back to the Mueller investigation, which goes to the obstruction. He was the one, even before he was Trump's lawyer, he was floating pardons. So it is, you know, like you could see them going after Rudy for three different crimes, the Ukraine one that we know about, and January 6th, which he obviously was in the thick of, and going back to the Mueller obstruction. So that's another one. And then, and this is one, like literally yesterday in a court, in a courtroom Zoom conference in Brooklyn, Tom Barrack, Trump's donor, Trump's biggest donor, was sitting there going, it must be politicized that, you know, back in 2019, we knew about this investigation, and it went nowhere. And now all of a sudden in 2021, remember, so DOJ is prosecuting Tom Barrack, Trump's donor, for being an agent of the Emirate government. And yes, he's claiming it's politicized. I don't see anyone, you know, squawking about it, though, because no one much cares about Tom Barrack anymore. But it is, again, another, like, if they succeed in that prosecution, they will basically show that Trump's biggest donor was leading him by the nose at the behest of the Emirate government and the Saudis too, by the way. But, you know, so those are how many cases, like the one I didn't name, but I promise you it'll be fun if it comes out. Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, and Tom Barrack. Those are all, you know, those are all proof that Merrick Garland is going after Trump's top people. And it, you know, and it's a combination of reopening stuff that Billy Barr shut down and new investigations into Sidney Powell and others. So it's clear he's not doing that.
Marcy Wheeler, I am comforted to talk to you today. I believe we are out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Sure, absolutely.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Jared Holt. Won't somebody please help me with my miseries? Can somebody see? Welcome back. I'm very happy to welcome Jared Holt to the show. Jared's been on before. He is one of a handful of researchers and journalists, mostly young ones, who have really carved out a beat in the extremism and disinformation realm. He is a fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab and someone I definitely wanted to catch up with as we mark the first anniversary of January 6th. And speaking of which, Jared is the author of a new report. It explains how some of the groups that attacked the Capitol and ancillary groups have adapted and evolved during the past year in response to changes in the environment, et cetera, et cetera. It is titled After the Insurrection, and you can find it at atlanticcouncil.org or just Google it. Jared, welcome back to We've Got Issues.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Before we dig in, Alan Foyer reported this week for the New York Times that while groups like the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers have been in the news and have had a bunch of their members charged in the insurrection, another group that isn't well known, called the First Amendment Praetorian, has emerged on the radar of congressional investigators looking into the attack. What do you know about this bunch, this First Amendment Praetorian?
So this is a group that styled itself in the way that many sort of militia movement groups do, say, in, you know, kind of privately, a lot of language that echoes militia movement stuff about, you know, needing to defend the Second Amendment and protect the First Amendment with the Second Amendment and all that kind of stuff. But the important thing to know about this group really is that it has a pretty deep connection since its founding to Mike Flynn, who has been in the news for years now for his mingling with far-right movements such as QAnon and his aggressive promotion of conspiracy theories about the election.
And according to Foyer, the other thing that stands out about this group is that it has among its membership, a lot of former special forces guys, a lot of intelligence guys. So this is a potentially dangerous group. And he makes Alan Foyer for the New York Times, makes it clear that we don't really know how deep their connection is to the attacks at this point. But this is something that I wanted listeners to just have on their radar because, you know, we've been talking about Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, et cetera. All right.
Yeah, this was a group that was at, you know, several like Stop the Steal events leading up to January 6th. We believe members were on the ground on January 6th. But yes, a lot of the extent of their involvement with what actually happened on January 6th still remains unclear. But the fact that the Select Committee has picked up on this group and is now looking into this group even though a lot of the work of this committee, you know, kind of feels slow because it's not public yet, the fact that this came on their radar at all is kind of assuring to me that they really are taking this seriously and digging deep.
Yeah, it seems like the Select Committee is pursuing a pretty expansive investigation. That's the way it feels from the outside. Let me ask you this. In the immediate aftermath of January 6th, did you feel that there was a potential, a possibility that the extremist movements, plural, which had kind of proliferated during the Trump era, might face a backlash and a decline in membership that was similar to what happened to the militia movement in the 90s following Timothy McVeigh's terror attack in the Oklahoma Federal Building?
I didn't know if it would be a perfect parallel. So for context, I've been doing this work for 6 or 7 years now. So the event in sort of my immediate consciousness is sort of what we saw happen to white supremacist groups after Unite the Right happened in Charlottesville in 2017. And a very similar pattern played out where this horrific thing happened. The groups went home thinking that they had accomplished something really amazing, were, you know, chattering among themselves about what comes next. And then as soon as law enforcement, public scrutiny, investigative reporting, and, you know, the forces in society, like as soon as society had the like immune response of sort of violently rejecting it, things started to turn south a little bit. And what our report lays out is that there actually was a few months at least where there seemed to be a bit of a freeze on public organizing. You know, these Proud Boys groups that were once very excited about what they had done at the Capitol, we're now telling members to just kind of disengage from politics and try to lay low for a little bit as, you know, they kind of wait and see what came out of this for their group and what that meant for their future.
Yeah. And part of what propelled the backlash against the militias in the 90s, you know, these groups had gained a lot of popularity during the Clinton years based on the idea that Clinton was some communist and black helicopters, UN black helicopters, a different era of similar nonsense. There was almost universal condemnation by the conservative establishment, including conservative pundits. And in this instance, that was true for a while, but never universally so. And now, as you talk about in the report, there is this kind of emerging revisionist history coming, this mythology that pushed by people like Tucker Carlson. We've talked about that on the show, that it was a false flag operation, etc. You write about paranoia becoming a common problem for many of these groups. Is that not a constant in extremist circles? I mean, don't they always kind of like assume that the FBI or Antifa or whomever is trying to infiltrate them?
Yeah, that is true. Paranoia is sort of paramount to the worldview of extremists, right? If you are not paranoid for your own immediate integrity of your group or whatever, you're paranoid that, you know, Jewish masterminds are orchestrating the downfall of America or something. And so that paranoia existing is not generally a new thing. But I guess maybe what was notable was that paranoia didn't get in the way of them, you know, organizing around Stop the Steal events, going out into the nation's capital, not just once on January 6th, but 3 times in total, November 14th, December 12th, and then again on January 6th. So they had made all of what they perceived to be these, you know, gains in the public spotlight. You know, they were showing up at these events. No one was telling them to scram or go home. And then that changed. And the paranoia that, you know, kind of does exist at the foundation of these movements really kind of arose up into the forefront of those movements. So, you know, a lot of these plans that kind of were floated around immediately in the wake of the Capitol riot for armed statehouse marches, you know, deploying to state capitals, returning to D.C., a lot of them, you know, kind of in the weeks that followed, were labeled by presumably the target audience for this conspiratorial and angry and hateful Trump supporters among that base as, you know, FBI honeypots. And we saw several times throughout the year whenever political rallies, you know, invoking J6 or having, you know, ties to these, you know, then known groups like the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys would show up, sort of a reflex in conspiratorial right-wing media would be to allege that, you know, what they were seeing was some sort of FBI plot. So it's not that the paranoia is particularly new, but I did think it was interesting and worth noting, you know, really how much mental energy that it's been occupying in these movements since January 6th.
And there's been a lot of dramatic increase in kind of infighting among these extremist groups, a lot of people calling each other grifters and hacks and snitches and et cetera, et cetera. So, and in some cases, you know, there's that old saying, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean somebody isn't following you. They had reason to be suspicious, right? Because you write that there was a series of like hacks and data breaches and of among extremist groups and far right platforms. And these breaches gave researchers a lot of information that they hadn't had previously, and which presumably ended up helping or are helping law enforcement sort out who's who. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, 2021 also saw, you know, after the Capitol riot, these groups became, you know, the target of like every bored hacker in their lair or whatever character of the hacker wearing the hoodie and sunglasses at the computer right. with the pistol next to them or something. But anyway, so like a lot of hackers, a lot of researchers, you know, kind of rushed after January 6th to try to figure these groups out. And we saw, you know, everything from platforms like Parler being, you know, scraped for all kinds of data and that data being published. We saw groups, you know, more specifically like the like some Three Percenters groups being just straight up hacked through their websites and having their membership roles spilled out. And then one of the most consequential things that happened in 2021 was a web hosting company called Epic, which has provided digital infrastructure for all kinds of hate groups and hate websites throughout the years, suffered a massive hack and data breach. And people are still to this day kind of going through it and trying to glean out, you know, previously unknown information. You know, a lot of reporting was done towards the end of 2021 about the membership roles of the Oath Keepers and just how many, you know, military members, law enforcement members, et cetera, were signed up in that group or, you know, that group had their contact information on file. And all of this is information that makes these groups more vulnerable. You know, they like to go bark out in public, but when it comes to sensitive information like that, many of them can be very cagey because the, you know, blowback for people who are discovered to be members of these groups or adherents to these groups can sometimes be severe, resulting in things like job loss and the like.
Yeah, they also found 40 local public officials, all Republicans, were members of the Oath Keeper, at least on their roster. So it's frightening stuff. The environment for these groups changed in other ways. Social media companies started to crack down on not only, you know, obviously Trump got booted off of Twitter and Facebook, but so did a lot of QAnon influencers and the like. How did these groups or individuals react to that?
So especially after Trump was banned, you know, a lot of these groups kind of scattered for a moment. In the report, we call it the Great Scattering, which is sounds silly, but it's what made sense at the time. You know, there's a whole host, and I mean, like dozens of these things, a whole charcuterie board worth of alternative platforms, some of which, explicitly market themselves to people with far right conspiratorial or extremist ideologies, things like Parler and Gab, built to be these right wing projects. And then there were other platforms that some, extremist communities went to seemingly out of convenience, things like MeWe, which really, to be completely fair to that company, despite it hosting extremist content for a period, it doesn't really present itself to audiences or like in a way that, markets itself to be a place for this kind of stuff. It's just a small social media company that has features similar to Facebook groups and what apparently was some severely lacking moderation on it. So there was a bit of a scattering there. Eventually, like as the year went on, we saw a lot of these communities kind of consolidate and settle on a smaller handful of these platforms, things like Telegram, Gab, Parler, of course, Rumble for video, and then some communities that weren't satisfied with those offerings have even built their own alternatives. All of that being said, so there was that migration and sort of planting of, trying to come up with some sort of backup plan and a new place online to find. But something that we also saw was, like with militia groups, for example, they usually try to get back on these mainstream platforms in some way, or at least get the content there, because it's even the most popular alternative platforms really can't hold a candle to the audience size of a platform like Facebook or Twitter.
Right. I mean, we see Marjorie Taylor Greene right now whining about not being on Twitter at the same time as she's saying that other conservatives should leave Twitter. So it's a little bit, there's that central contradiction that if your real goal is just to troll liberals, then going to a site that has no liberals isn't going to help you in any way.
And if you go to these sites too, it's like you'll realize very quickly how much of the content is derivative from stuff that appears on mainstream sites.
Right.
So you're flipping through Parler and it's people screaming about screenshots from Twitter and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And one way you know that I'm an elitist, East Coast elitist, is that I always have it in my head, I think parlay, like in French.
Well, I think that's how they were trying to get people to pronounce it. But
didn't work. I mean, that is too foreign for a lot of these people.
The good old boy Southerner in me will always say parlor.
Now, we are, of course, talking about a lot of disparate groups and individuals in some cases. And I should say that Jaron's report goes into a lot of detail, and I would encourage listeners to check it out. In broad terms, can you kind of talk about how the MAGA-oriented extremist movement in this country has shifted its tactics in response to these changes in the environment, in response to, the response to January 6th, etc.?
Yeah, so this report, I would, of course, encourage you to read it because I spent so long writing it. I would love for you to read it. But if I was going to distill it down, kind of two big things are happening. And they're different, almost polar opposite, but they're working together. They're not contradictory. So as far as the ideology of the far right, the anti-democratic right wing that was angry that, they feel the Republican Party didn't do enough, both at the national, state, local, et cetera, level to make sure Trump was, given the crown in an election that he didn't win. They have been aggressively pushing toward the mainstream. They're doing things like hosting conferences, trying to loop in elected officials to their causes, things like the white nationalist movement, faction that's sort of spearheaded by podcaster Nick Fuentes has been doing this. Several QAnon influencers have been doing this. And they've found some help in people like Tucker Carlson, who are willing to take their ideology and present it to the masses. So ideologically, you know, there have been some pretty alarming gains for people that have intentions like that. Meanwhile, when it comes to boots on the ground organizing in the far right, a lot of that has shifted down to the state, local, and regional level. A lot of that, you know, there is not really, even to this day, a lot of appetite to organize a large rally around these same kind of causes in DC. Instead, leaders in these movements are explicitly encouraging people to take their angst and take their anger and, you know, go hit up the local school board about CRT or go yell at your city council about mask mandates and that sort of thing. And probably the most alarming development has been demagogues like Steve Bannon encouraging people, and, you know, Bannon has the ear of many elected officials, so it's kind of a repeating megaphone, to, you know, seek out these positions in their local election boards, precincts of Republican parties, and to go into there and kind of, you know, seek out a type of revenge. They don't think that these institutions, which have a very kind of black and white job to do, which in the case of a state election board, which is just make sure the election looked legit and you know, approve it and certify it and pass it up the chain, you know, they want to get in there and junk up the process and you know, sort of stall out results that don't align with their agenda. So, you know, there, it's both crawling even further into the mainstream over the last year, while at the same time, the byproduct of it, the organizing part of it, is decentralizing off of the national stage.
Yeah. Jared, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it. And folks, listen, you should check out the report because I have like six more questions that I had prepped for this. And there's just a lot in there. I really do suggest that you go Google that report and check it out. Jared, thanks again for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do go check out the report. I can be a little long-winded sometimes because all this poison in my brain, I get a question. It's just like
I don't even know how you deal with it, honestly.
The like cork pops and it just all comes out. But if you want to read like 40 pages worth of that, AtlanticCouncil.org is where you can find that.
After the insurrection, AtlanticCouncil.org. Thanks again.
Thanks.
I also want to thank Marcy Wheeler and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I'd like to thank all of you fine and discerning people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Where did that